You're listening to this week's excerpt from the Dear Prudence podcast. To get the full-length members-only version every week, join Slate Plus at slate.com/prudypod.
Dear Prudence.
Do you think that I should contact him again?
Thank you.
Hello, and welcome back to the Dear Prudence Show once again. And as always, I am your host, Dear Prudence, otherwise known as Daniel Mallory Ortberg. With me in the studio this week is Zara Norbash, co-host of the hashtag Good Muslim, Bad Muslim podcast. And the Pop Culture Collaborative has named her their senior fellow on comedy for social change. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Congratulations on being named something.
Thank you.
How's that feel?
I love titles.
It's kind of cool, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially on comedy right now. Like, so much is happening with comedy.
Would you like to talk about any of it?
Yes.
What's your favorite change?
Well, definitely Hannah Gatsby's special that is being called a comedy special, right? Like, people aren't referring to it as a one-person show. They're referring to it as a comedy special, which I think is fantastic.
The Nanette discourse.
Yes.
I have seen the Nanette discourse, like, cascading over my timeline for months. And I still have not seen it.
Oh, I can't wait for you to see it.
All right. I will add that to the list of things that my guests have told me to see.
Yeah. It has the number of one-person shows like Hasan Minhaj's Homecoming King that are being regarded as comedy specials is a really big deal, because when folks who are categorized as quote-unquote other, whether we're people of color or identify as LGBTQ or women, just not cis, hetero, white males, basically.
I remember that special. Yeah, it felt very much like some comedy, some like memoir slideshow,
right?
Some something else.
Right.
And I also remember that he's very, very handsome, which is not the point, but I just remember that.
He's ridiculously
handsome.
Telegenic. Yes.
He's wonderful.
Whenever folks who are categorized as other have a comedy special, it gets relegated to the category of one-person show because there's an amount of, quote, you know, educating that has to happen. And versus the stand-up comedy scene that is a bar scene where it's just like set up, punchline. But part of the reason why they get to do that is because they don't have to do all this educating, you know. And so I'm just really glad that these aren't just being called one-person shows, that they're also being seen and regarded for what is their vocation and trade and careers, comedy specials.
I'm all for more of that. I am also excited then to treat the letters today as one-person shows.
I like that.
To think about, like, what's this person trying to tell me about their life and their choices? And the first one... It's sort of near and dear to my heart, just because I feel like there's a number of categories that, like, if you simply say them in an advice column, you will get people out of the woodwork for days. And picky eating, or the idea of picky eating, is definitely one of them.
Oh, man.
No shortage of opinions on picky eating.
Especially in the Bay Area.
Especially, as you say, in the Bay Area. So lucky you, you get to read that letter. Would you do us the honor of kicking it off?
Yes. Impossibly picky husband. Dear Prudence, my husband and I have been married for a few years. We have gradually stopped getting invitations to my family's events and vacations. The problem is that my husband has a medical condition that creates very real dietary restrictions and is also an incredibly picky eater. Trying to figure out how to eat with him is regularly a nightmare. After narrowing possible choices down to what he can eat, he will often rule out almost everything on the grounds that he doesn't want to eat it. It's tedious and frustrating for everyone involved. My family has responded by inviting us to fewer and fewer family things. I've talked to my husband about his pickiness and the impact it has, but he says he just cares about food more than I do. I miss my family. How can I fix this?
So I think it's important to start by saying, I have no interest in saying people who are picky eaters should become non-picky eaters, or that you will automatically become a better person if you eat lots and lots of things off of a menu. So, you know, if your husband, in addition to his medical restrictions, is a picky eater, that's not in itself a problem. The problem is two things, I think. One is that apparently he has made you and also your family responsible for his food choices, which is not cool. And the other is that he says he just cares about food more than I do. That's not the problem. The problem's not that he cares a lot about food. The problem is that he doesn't seem to be putting any time or energy or investment ahead of time, if he knows he's going to be going somewhere where he can't eat things, into figuring out how's he going to eat.
Yeah, there. I have so many questions, like, for the husband, you know, and about the husband, in terms of, like, this is starting to seem to me almost like a manipulative tactic.
Yeah. If he's making it so much other people's problems that they're like, it is not worth inviting him over anymore.
Exactly.
Why has he not, like, called ahead to the restaurant, or, like, advocated for more restaurants that can accommodate his restrictions? Or, you know, if it's not eating a meal out in a restaurant, bringing his own food.
Yeah, or just eat in advance and show up to the restaurant just to hang.
Right. It doesn't. It would be one thing if it was like, my husband knows all this. He's really well prepared. He always has accommodations, like, in hand, or at least is aware of what he could do. But my family is being a real jerk about it. That's not the case here at all. It sounds like every time a meal is involved, he acts like it is a surprise.
That's right. Yeah. Especially if this is like an ongoing thing and there's clearly like some solutions around it. It feels like a manipulative tactic. There's a little bit of like attention hoarding that it feels like is happening a bit. Right. Like the partners become sort of isolated and with the husband all the time.
Yeah.
Like thinking about his food, thinking about his health. Like, what about theirs?
Yeah. Yeah. And for your husband, like, again, I don't want to say anybody with any dietary restrictions should just 100% of the time be like super, super focused and prepared and never ask other people to kind of meet them halfway. But that's not the case here. Like, why doesn't your husband bring his own food to these events? Like, why doesn't he think, what would he like to eat, and then make that happen?
Yeah. I mean, I went through a whole year and a half where I was on this acid reflux diet, where literally all I could have was yogurt and bread and steamed chicken and nothing that could make anything taste good.
That's restrictive.
Pretty restrictive. Most of the time I would eat in advance and just go hang out, mm-hmm. you know? And I like sent out an email to a bunch of my friends to let them know, hey, like, don't feel bad. Don't feel like you have to make me have yummy food. Like, this is my situation. So we can hang.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it'd be one thing if your husband was doing that and then the family was like, simply seeing him have to have dietary restrictions is so unfun for us. We don't want him around. But again, not the case. So I think for you, letter writer, number one, you know, talk to your family. Tell them that you miss them. Tell them that you would like to attend these events, even if your husband can't. And also, I think, talk with your husband about, you know, like, I want to go to this family event. You know that they won't have any of the handful of items that you can eat. I would love for you to come. Please make or bring something for yourself. And if that doesn't sound fun to you, I'm going to go anyways. But have that conversation. I mean, don't let the fact that he's being so begrudging about planning ahead that it keeps you from seeing your family.
I have one other tactic.
Okay.
Something I do with my husband, just because he is a serious introvert. Mm-hmm. I tell him he has two events that he has to go to with me per month, and he gets to choose in advance which two they are. You know, give him, hey, I've got two things. I want you to two family things. Figure out when's the best time.
Right. Yeah. And obviously, like, that's going to be a compromise that'll look different in different marriages. But yeah, I like the idea of saying, like, okay, we're not going to be able to do my thing, which is we would go to everything. And we're not going to do your thing, which is never see my family again. And I would like to sometimes, as a couple, go see my family. And that's not unreasonable. So if we can together agree upon a number that works for both of us, even if it wouldn't be our first choice, then we can sort of plan ahead so that, all right, you know, we know next month we're going to be all getting together at grandma's house. What can you bring in advance? And you know, if your husband cares this much about food, encourage him to channel that energy into making his own food. Because I worry that, like, the thing that I would worry about here would be that he would say, like, fine, you make me something. And again, in any marriage, there's going to be some give and take. There's going to be acts of service that both people can perform for each other. I'm not saying begrudge your husband any help. But since his strategy up until now has been to kind of hold everyone else hostage so that if he can't get everything he wants, he's kind of a jerk about it. And again, this is so separate from the like medical issue. That's simply something outside of his control. I'm talking about the stuff that he very clearly can control. If his response is like, fine, I'm either going to be like a real jerk when we get together, or you can make me something, you know, he's a grown man.
Let him be a grown man.
Yeah. Let him look up a recipe. And if there's that whole like, well, I care about food, but I've never cooked anything. Like, you can learn. I think that that is a good idea, because I don't understand right now why he has apparently never tried to bring something he can eat.
It sounds like he doesn't really like eating. Right.
I don't know. Maybe. I mean, I don't want to like speculate. He says he cares a lot about food. I'm sure this is frustrating for him. Like, I cannot imagine that he like loves having serious medical restrictions. And then on top of that, you know, a lot of food that he doesn't like to eat. But it does sound like he's maybe kind of getting something out of feeling like, well, if this is not going to be centered around me, then no one's going to enjoy it. I'm not going to go.
Yeah.
My wife's not going to go.
It makes me a little bit curious about depression involved. I am speculating.
Yeah, I don't know. And it's hard because there's a lot of behavior that, absent other information, certainly could fall under the umbrella of some sort of untreated depression, could fall under garden variety bad behavior, could be totally unrelated. So mostly, I think, just focus on the stuff that you can control or the stuff that you can talk about. And certainly, yeah, ask. What does it feel like? Maybe if you talk to him, he's like, actually, your family members are often super rude. And it's not just that I have a restricted set of items I can eat. It's that everyone's always asking me like frustrating questions or like pointing out what I am or am not eating. And if that's coming up, then that's worth talking about with him and talking about with your family.
Or what if it's that at every family function 24/7, they require that he eats nothing but chicken and waffles?
I don't know.
Maybe that's like a mandatory thing. Maybe they like shove it in his face and they're like, and plus syrup and plus everything that'll make you sick.
Yes, certainly if anybody has been trying to push food on him that he knows will make him sick, that would be something to address as well. I do want to give some room to the possibility that, because some people sometimes get really judgmental about someone when they can't eat something. They sometimes take it as a personal affront because food is very intimate and people often make bad decisions when they feel slighted. But yeah, there's you do not have to simply never see your family again because your husband is boorish about menus.
No. No.
Absolutely accommodate the medical stuff. Certainly, I don't think you're going to transform him into a guy who loves like oysters and, you know, all numbers of sort of like outre food items. That is the first time I've said that word out loud. I don't know if
outre.
I pronounced it correctly. I know how to write it, but that's it. Yeah. You don't have to push for that, but certainly he should take more responsibility for figuring out when and where he can eat something and for making alternate arrangements if he can't. And that's very specific, too. I feel anxious about the idea of someone listening to this and thinking that I'm saying anybody with medical restrictions is just like on your own, show up with a backpack full of cashews or like get yelled at. I definitely don't.
I know what to do when I go to the restaurant with you now.
Oh, man.
A
backpack full of cashews that just like loose cashews, just like a pill bottle that's exploded. That's just like all I can picture right now. Good luck. This will be a number of conversations. Oh, God, this next letter.
Yes.
Oh, this one's rough.
This made me so sad.
This made me sad and scared for the letter writer. Would you read it?
Here goes. The subject is, my husband wants to die. Do I have the right to stop him? Dear Prudence, several years ago, my husband told me that he found life unbearable. It was devastating to hear, but we had a long conversation and he agreed he'd meet with a therapist and would take no action while our children were still at home. He's kept his word, gone to therapy regularly, and has steadfastly insisted through it all that he finds his life dreary and wants to end it. Our youngest moves out soon, and after that happens, my husband intends to kill himself. If he was depressed or irrational, I would have no hesitation in calling the authorities. But he's been consistent in his views for years, explored all available alternatives, and remains determined to carry through. I also fear that involving others would put them at risk, as he is quite formidable. I'm at a loss. Do I just submit to his will? Do I even have the right to try to stop him at this point? That is terrifying.
Yeah, I don't even have a sound to make right now. I think one thing that feels worth distinguishing here is that I think there's more going on simply than just that your husband needs and is seeking treatment. It also feels like he is using the threat of suicide to keep you close and to keep you keeping secrets. And that worries. That's why I said, like, I'm worried for the letter writer's safety. I'm kind of.
Yeah, I see that now. That sentence, I also fear that involving others would put them at risk, as he is quite formidable.
Yeah, the end is really what got me thinking this is like an abusive threat of suicide. The implication that he would try to hurt other people, the language around submitting to his will, and asking if she has the right to try to stop him. That really concerns me. So, letter writer, you have spent years trying to help your husband and going, you know, helping him find a therapist. But I think what you need right now is help yourself. And so I think telling somebody else in your life that you trust, speaking to your doctor, speaking to a therapist of your own about these concerns that you have, and answering really honestly the question, like, do you feel safe in the house with him? Do you think there's any chance that he would try to hurt you? And to answer that question really, really honestly, because it sounds like you do fear that, and that's part of the reason that you're writing now is that if I try to, quote unquote, stop him, he will also try to kill me. And that's what divides this from, like, it's not just a question of, like, does a person have some kind of right to end their life if they have tried other resources. I think this is more to do with a man who has either implicitly or possibly explicitly made it clear that he may hurt other people. And at that point, you know, your safety, letter writer, is my number one concern. So please talk to your doctor. Please talk to a therapist. Please talk to somebody else in your life and, you know, figure out what you need to do to be safe. I think, you know, I know that it is not a perfect option, but I think the National Suicide Prevention Hotline or even the National Domestic Abuse Prevention Hotline may be useful to you. And we'll try to add those in at the end of the show. Because what you're describing here just sounds like so much more than simply a husband who is struggling with his own thoughts of suicidal ideation. You know, that line too, if he was depressed or irrational, I would have no hesitation in calling the authorities, but he's been consistent in his views for years. That is not the opposite of irrational. A person can be consistently irrational. A person can develop a twisted sort of logic that they are very, that they adhere to, but that does not mean that the way that they are behaving is safe or appropriate or healthy.
It also makes me really wonder about what's going on with, you know, who's in charge of what is and isn't irrational in this relationship.
Right. Right. Like, if he can kind of logic his way to, here's why I should be able to do this, then her job is just to support, keep that secret, be present for that, you know.
That's how he's presenting it.
Right. So I think you have done a lot already to try to offer him help and support. It does not sound like it has been useful. And I don't mean to say that, like, help is fixing someone until they no longer struggle with suicidal ideation. But I mean the way that he is dealing with this, which is like, you, wife, are kind of responsible for helping me carry out a plan where we get the children out of the house. And then I get to harm myself in a way that may involve other people. And you know, again, like the idea of, we'll get the kids out and safe, but you'll stay here with me. That scares me a lot. That makes me question what his intentions are for you. And, you know, there's enough red flags in here that I think you should be talking to, you know, a medical authority, a mental health authority, experts in the field, people in your life, and be very, very honest about whether or not you think he would ever hurt you. Because if there's even a chance that you think the answer might be yes, and you're hoping that if you don't try to get in his way and act just right, you will be able to keep him from harming you, then you are in an abusive situation and you need help and support in getting out, because my guess is that he may try to escalate if you do try to leave, or if you do try to talk about this openly, or if you do ask for help and support. Yeah, I think right now it sounds like your husband's sort of irrational logic has sort of carried the order of the day, and that both you and him sort of believe, because he has wanted to do this for a really long time, because he has talked about it for a really long time, he is sort of earning credits toward getting to do it.
Mm.
And I think that that is not an accurate view of reality, and that you need to talk about this with other people in your life. You need to stop keeping this secret for him because it affects you and your own safety.
Yeah, there is this like really alarming that's amazing that now that you're saying about it, I hadn't even thought about it this way, that if this is such a source of pain, then why aren't we opening up and involving more people?
Yeah, I think the fact that it's just him and his therapist every week, I'm just wondering, how honest is he with this therapist? What are the goals of that therapy? Why does it seem that the goals of that therapy seem to be he talks to one person every once in a while, but nobody else talks about this? And again, I can certainly understand that there's lots of shame and social judgment when it comes to things like depression or suicidal ideation. But just reading between the lines here, there's so many red flags. And the fact that she's apparently talked about this with no one else makes me feel like this is a strategy rather than somebody who is actually struggling with suicidal ideation that is not also about violence and control of other people.
Mm-hmm.
And it is hard. Like, I did, you know, it took me a couple times to read through this to think, like, why do I feel so unsettled? I mean, certainly it would be an unsettling letter no matter what. Of course, it would be difficult and painful if the person that you loved and married was hopeless and suicidal. But it felt like there's more here, and I'm not quite sure what it is, because it doesn't seem like the letter writer is quite aware of what it is. But I think it's that. I think it's there's clear themes of domination, control, and the threat of violence in order to keep her compliant. And I do want to acknowledge that in a situation like this, if you were to talk about it, if he were to feel like you had broken a trust, if he were to feel like you were trying to leave him, often that's when the odds of violence go up. And so, letter writer, I hope that you can be very careful and judicious about who you talk to. I hope that you can make those calls in private, somewhere where you know that your husband won't be able to listen in, that you can make a safety plan for figuring out how you would get out of the house if you needed to get out of the house in a hurry, and to do so in ways that do not unnecessarily draw attention to yourself and to your choices. But if nothing else, please don't feel like only if you follow his rules or do the right things in the right order that you can keep him from hurting himself. I think that's the biggest thing to take away from this, is not if you are a good enough partner and a good enough wife, you can keep people safe from him. Like, he is making implicit or explicit threats, and you're not going to be able to stop him from choosing to do those things by being compliant and not looking out for your own safety. So I hope so much that you do. I hope so much that you reach out. I'm so sorry. This sounds absolutely agonizing. I cannot imagine going through this for years. And I hope that you write back and let us know how you're doing.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Mm. All right. So, you know, just continuing in the veins of challenging husbands of varying degrees, this next letter is all about, again, another husband who has not yet taken the time to find good, useful coping strategies for his feelings, is my take on it. And with a nice side dose of ableism. It is not a nice side dose. It is a bad side dose.
Oh, boy.
So the subject is, our baby probably won't be a serial killer, right? Dear Prudence, like anyone who has ever written to you with a relationship problem, my marriage is almost completely perfect, except for one big place where it isn't: babies. Before we got married, I had a serious talk with my husband about having kids. I told him I wanted them, and he needed to let me know if he didn't. He said he was okay without them, but that he would love to have babies with me. I should stop here and say that my husband is a pessimist, although like all pessimists, he calls himself a realist. Every big decision is met with a list of all the ways it could go wrong before he finally makes the leap and is almost always happy with the outcome. Now we've been married for 4 years and I've been trying to get pregnant for 3. We've started fertility treatments and I'm due to start the IVF process in 3 weeks. My husband is freaking out. He says he still wants to do it and is all in, but he's constantly talking about everything that could go wrong. What if it ruins our lives? What if the kid has a disability or is a serial killer? What if he hates it? What if we both lose our jobs and can't pay back the substantial loan we already took out to have the IVF? On and on and on. This is already a difficult process for me, and there's no guarantee the treatment will even work. I told him we didn't have to do it, but his answer is always that he's just talking, and he needs to be able to tell me his fear. I want kids, but I'm now terrified something will go wrong, and he'll say, "I told you so." I work with kids and have a number of younger siblings, so I know parenting isn't easy. And I, of course, have my own doubts too, but his are starting to overwhelm me. How do I continue to support my husband without being consumed by his doubts and pessimism?
Oh, man, that is so hard.
Yeah, number one, I'd like to draw a big distinction between talking about your fears and endlessly running out a list of bad scenarios. They are not the same thing. And your husband is not having a healthy series of conversations with you about fears and what you guys will do in a number of possible circumstances. He is trying to, fix his own anxiety by just running on a hamster wheel of anxiety, which actually just begets more. So his strategy right now is not just talking about his fears.
No.
The other one that just really stood out to me, it's not that your husband said, "Hey, let's talk through how we would want to help our child if they were born with a disability or if either one of us ever became disabled and talk honestly about what would be hard about that, what we would want to do, how we would want to prioritize our child's care, how we would step up and learn more. It's just, what if? Wouldn't that be awful?" And that is an attitude that is part of what makes life really, really difficult for people with disabilities, is this idea that I only want a child if I can guarantee like a certain degree of physical ability, and anything other than that would just be awful. And that breaks my heart. That feels a little distinct from everything else, actually, like, because you can kind of say like, well, no one knows if someone's going to be a serial killer. They're actually, not that common. We just happen to have a lot of documentaries and movies about them, so we think that they're everywhere. We could cross that bridge when we come to it, I guess. If our child kills people serially.
There's a couple milestones before killing people serially.
Yeah. Step one is just going to be like breastfeeding or bottle feeding,
Right,
like,
lots of holding.
Yeah. So, the remark about, what if our child has a disability, that one just really stood out to me. And I think you'll want to have a conversation there about how would we love and support our child would be the question there. Not, let's not do it because what if we didn't have the,
Right.
That's just, that's not great. So that aside, you guys have been trying to have a kid for 3 years. That sounds really challenging.
I mean, I also really feel for her that on top of all of this like future tripping that he's having, these thought patterns that he's going through, she's going through a lot of hormone treatments.
Yeah. Well, she says due to start the IVF process in 3 weeks. Has that started yet, do you think? Then like would she be already taking injections or...
I believe so, because I believe there's some prep.
Okay.
And this is near in my future as well, so.
Okay.
That I just really empathize. That's really hard.
Yeah.
And especially being tasked with being the person to receive all the anxiety.
Right.
That's not fair.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one thing to have a series of difficult conversations. It's another thing to say, like, you, my wife, need to just be, like, available for this big Eeyore cloud that kind of never lifts.
And it's not like she doesn't have her own fears.
Right. Yeah.
So I see this happen a lot, in a lot of like relationship dynamics where one person is tasked with being the optimist.
Mm.
And it's so unfair.
Yeah.
And it's scary because then you're afraid that if you voice your fears, too, then down goes the ship.
Right. Because they're not going to listen and talk through it with you. They're just going to say, oh, God, you've given me 8 new things to freak out about.
Now we're both spinning out.
Yeah. Yeah. So what your husband's doing is not just talking. What your husband is doing is unloading an unreasonable number of unfixable, unknowable future scenarios. And what he needs to do is figure out when and where he can have a productive conversation with you about them that is not every day. And the rest of the time, you know, he needs to figure out how to manage those anxieties, whether that be get a journal and write his feelings down.
I was going to say, one time I was tasked with keeping a note card and tallying every time I had the same fear.
Yeah.
And after a while, you know, after five tallies in a day, like, it was more annoying to take out the pen and note card than it was to have the thought.
Right. And it kind of helps you realize, like, oh, this is not simply a totally proportionate response to a realistic threat. This is my brain spinning out possible nightmare scenarios because it makes me feel safe to be always anxious.
Exactly.
Because if I'm always anxious, then an anxiety can't threaten my happiness because I have no happiness.
Right.
I threw it in the ocean.
Exactly. Which is, I think, a big part of being the I told you so hero. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like you're standing on the sideline instead of actually being in the game.
Right. So, yeah, number one is he needs to take some responsibility for managing his unreasonable anxieties, which is, you know, write them down in a journal, see a therapist, schedule a weekly coffee with a friend you are not married to and having a baby, trying to have a baby with, so that you can just kind of unload and then ask them how they're doing. Figure out a space that's not just talking to you all the time, because it's not just talking. That's not what it is. And then to, you know, letter writer, to advocate for yourself. When we have these conversations, I'm going to need to talk about the things that I'm afraid of. And I would like to put that pessimism to good use by saying, if this happens, what will we do? How will we learn more? How will we arm ourselves with information and make a plan? I want to come up with action plans together. And then also, I think, to have a bigger conversation about, like, how are we doing? 3 years of trying to have a baby in, about to start IVF, you know, do we both have kind of an idea in mind at which point we would no longer want to try having a baby biologically and look into other options or taking a break? You know, you've already taken out loans. You're already 3 years in. Check in about that and be brutally honest with one another. Like, even if you don't decide we're going to stop, if you both just want to say, I feel exhausted and like this might never happen. And if this doesn't happen and we spend all this money on IVF, will I feel like at least we tried everything? Or will I feel like, wow, I wish we hadn't taken it this far?
Yeah, I think that's the antidote to being the I told you so hero or having one in the equation.
Yeah.
There's one thing I do also want to add that I'm hearing from the husband is there's this subtext there that is, I'm afraid I'm going to be inadequate. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if when he's saying, you know, you got to listen to my fears, you got to listen to my fears, I wonder if there's a way to ask him, what are these fears actually about? Mm-hmm. A lot of it I'm hearing is like, what if I can't provide for blank scenario?
Right.
What if I can't provide for this other scenario?
Yeah. Yeah. And so to just kind of stop and talk through like what we do, like what if we have a baby and you hate it? I guess my first question would be like, on what grounds? Like, do you mean that you would feel an instant sense of panic and regret because you're now responsible to something that needs you? Because that's big and that makes sense. But if you mean you would just look at a baby and think like, this baby's the worst, like, probably that won't happen because babies don't do anything.
I mean, my dad, when he first gazed at me, was terrified and thought I looked like a lizard.
Of course, terror, panic, a sense of inadequacy, a fear of harming what appears to be a blank slate of a baby, those all make a lot of sense.
Yep.
Talk about those things so that they don't feel like the unspeakable. Because if it's, you know, what would you do if you, you know, had a baby and your first thought was, fuck, you know, like come up with a worst case scenario plan. Like, you know, well, we could give the child up for adoption. We could find a loving couple who is desperate to have and raise a child and give the child to them. That's a worst case scenario for us. We would feel very foolish having, you know, done all this to make a baby and then changing our minds. But we could do that if we had to. And that would make life challenging in a lot of ways, but it would be okay. No one would be dead. You know, we could also go to therapy, hire some help, ask our family members to help us with raising the child. Act lovingly towards the child, regardless of whether or not we felt, you know, indifferent or anxious or panicked in the moment. And probably if you do that, if it is your child and you've worked this hard to make one, eventually you will, you know, one day see the baby smiling or looking like the face of the person you love. And you will think, I have feelings of warmth toward this baby, you know, like,
hey, postpartum for fathers is a real thing. It's a thing that happens. It's a good thing to prepare for.
Yeah. And
there are a lot of new parent fears here as well.
And I also you know, stop and check in with both yourself and your husband. Like, he started out by saying, I'm okay without kids, but I'd love to have babies with you. And now that you're, you know, on the verge of taking another step towards trying to have a child, you know, he's sort of spinning out. You know, ask that question, like, get really honest with each other. Like, is part of the reason that you're bringing all these things up because you feel like you cannot say to me, I actually don't want to anymore.
Right.
Because better to have that conversation now than when you're, you know, a couple months pregnant or when you're holding a baby. And that's, you know, a little hard because sometimes people will do anything to avoid saying the thing they don't want to say. But certainly this state of affairs cannot continue. You need more from your husband than this. He needs to figure out other ways of dealing with his feelings than just telling you all of them the second they come to mind.
Yeah, fears and feelings are a bit different.
Mm-hmm.
To say I'm feeling unprepared, I'm feeling terrified, is different to say than to say, what if?
Yeah. And it may also help to talk to other people who have spent a long time trying to get pregnant, because a lot of parents, first-time parents, panic beforehand. And a lot of people have the questions of, what if my baby's a murderer? What if,
yes,
you know, I have no feelings of love? What if, unlike the vast, vast majority of people who have children, my first reaction to my child is just, I hate this? You know, this is not an uncommon fear.
No, it's also not an uncommon reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the answer is not just going to be, don't worry, as soon as you see the baby, you will never have a fear again.
No.
Life is full of fear. Life is serious. A child is a big thing, and it makes sense that big feelings come up. You just got to figure out a better strategy than what you're doing right now, my guy. All right. Oh, man. Very narrow focus this week, which is just bad relationships. But at least I don't have to read this one. You have to.
I do. Subject is, friend is enabling her boyfriend having sex with much younger people. Dear Prudence, a friend of mine is in a relationship with a much older man. She's 25, he's 45. They often have sex with other people together, which I usually don't care about. Recently, she told me that they had a threesome with a 17-year-old. The legal age of consent here is 16. I said this was absolutely not okay, that there was no way a 45-year-old should ever be sexually involved with a 17-year-old, and that she was enabling this. She told me the girl initially didn't really want to sleep with her boyfriend and just wanted to sleep with her. She has now ended the friendship and uninvited me from her wedding because I confronted her about this. There have been other red flags, but until now, I have supported her because I don't want her to be more isolated and dependent on him. But if she's bringing other more vulnerable people into the situation, I have to draw the line. Am I right that this is completely unacceptable? And is there anything else I should do beyond calling her out on it?
Man. I'm so sorry. This is deeply fucked up.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Ugh.
I do think that the letter writer has drawn the line in the right place. Like, I can understand why, you know, your friend being 25 to his 45, there's enough of a gap there that you may have at first been sort of primarily concerned for whether or not she was being in some ways manipulated or taken advantage of. But she is also, you know, she is in her mid-20s. She is an adult. The difference between 25 and 17 is pretty serious. And if she is pressuring 17-year-olds into having sex with her partner, against their stated wishes, you know, at best, you know, she is behaving incredibly manipulatively.
Yes.
And at worst, she is committing sexual assault.
I was going to say, this sounds like sexual assault.
Yeah. I just, yeah, you know, and so the thing about the age of consent being 16, you know, being one birthday on the right side of the law is one thing, but I think you are absolutely right to say, like, that does not make this an okay situation. And certainly when we know that the girl initially did not want to, that the idea of sleeping with another woman within, you know, 10 years of her own age felt like a very different proposition from sleeping with a 45-year-old man. And frankly, you don't even need a reason. To want to sleep with one person and not another person is the only reason you would need. Is incredibly, incredibly worrying behavior. That is a huge red flag. And you were right to, at this point, say, okay, my concern about her being isolated and dependent now has to give way to my concern for the more vulnerable person in the situation, which was the 17-year-old girl.
What would you advise doing in that scenario? Like, would you, because I know if it was me, I would like wonder, should I call the parents of the 17-year-old?
I think, you know, I don't think that the letter writer knows who the 17-year-old person was. Mm. I don't know that they would have any way of getting in touch with that person. I think if I were to advise anyone to do any contacting, it would not be to that person's parents. Mm. It would be to the person in question, simply to say, are you okay?
Are you okay? Yeah.
Do you need anything? How can I help support you? And if their answer to that is, you know, nothing, leave me alone, respect that. If their answer is there is something that you can help me do and a way that you can help support me, take that into consideration. But to go to that person's parents, I think would to once again.
No, you're absolutely right.
Because she needs agency in this situation, right?
Like,
yes. She's already had it possibly taken from her once. And mm-hmm. I think it would. You would really want to stress if you had any way of getting in touch with her and you thought she might welcome hearing from you, to really stress.
Yeah, and what I did there is something I feel like is a common pitfall when it comes to adolescence and anything, is treating them like they're not also thinking beings with agency.
Well, and that's the hard thing, right? Like, if this was a clear legal issue, if this person was under the age of consent and was a younger teenager, I would say at that point, absolutely, you know, try to find and involve the parents if that person has been like, but if that person is over the age of consent, then I think the thing to focus on is not her parents, but simply, because her age was not the problem. The problem was that she went over there expecting to have sex with one person and was either talked into or manipulated or pressured or coerced into having sex with someone else. So since that's the situation, it's not her age that's the factor, it would make more sense to go to her as the victim rather than to involve her family. Mm. Had she been a child whose charge needed to know so that they could help protect her. And I would be real careful around, you know, if you don't know who the 17-year-old is, I don't know that digging around and contacting them out of the blue and saying like, hey, I'm friends with the people who like may have either sexually assaulted you or at the very least put you in a really like uncomfortable situation. And I want to know if you need anything, that might not be welcome.
Mm-hmm.
But absolutely to say to your friend, this is not okay. I'm not comfortable with this. This feels predatory and manipulative.
Predatory is the word.
Predatory is the word. And I don't support it. I love you. I hope that you can get out of this relationship. I'm available if you are ever ready to leave. But when you started involving other people, it started getting bigger than just you. And I can't support this wedding.
Yeah. I like the ending the friendship and uninviting her from the wedding feels almost like, hey, you know what? Then you're doing it right.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, if there's anything else you can do beyond calling her out on it, I don't know that there is. Like, again, if you knew who this person was, if she had said to you, yep, she really didn't want to do it, but then we just, like, bowled over her and did it anyways, then, you know, you would at least have the question of, do I involve the authorities in this? But that raises a whole host of other questions, like, would that actually improve the victim's quality of life? Is that what the victim wants? Would you be railroading over her again? So I think, you know, the question of have I done all I can in this situation, you may have already done all you can, and your friend has made it very clear that she has no interest in examining this behavior or in trying to make amends or to behave differently in the future. And that's really sad. Like, because I'm sure that there are ways in which he is manipulating or taking advantage of her, but...
Yeah, I mean, it also sounds like it's just getting started.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and she's doubling down on this, and she has not asked you for help. She has not said, I didn't want to do it, but he made me. She has said, this other girl didn't want to, but I made her. I mean,
wow.
I don't want to, like, overstate. She did not say, I made her, but it certainly sounds like there was a pretty big question of whether or not this young woman, this teenager, meaningfully consented to what they did together, and that's a... You got to talk, you know, if you don't ask your friends about that when they tell you something like that, like, no one's going to.
No.
And I'm really sorry. That's just dark. And, you know, if you, I think the only other thing that I would say is if you happen to know other people who you think may be involved, or other people that you see them maybe like trying to hang around or to rope into.
I was just thinking, is there a way to make people aware?
Yeah. There's a limit to what you can do. But if you know of someone else, like if somebody ever says, hey, do you know these people? You know, they're trying to ask me out or to see if I'll join them. What do you know? I think certainly to say, I actually had to end my friendship with them because there was a question of whether or not they pressured a very young person into having sex with them, and they did not want to talk about it. They did not want to hear about it. Then that is a good thing to say. And I'm just so sorry. That's all I got. I just feel really bad about this one. This one just feels heavy.
Yeah, I'm just the 45-year-old guy, like, cruising.
Yeah. Yeah, and I just, like,
yep. You're a grown man. You've got this young woman.
Who it sounds like in some ways he's just kind of using as bait for younger women.
That's what it sounds like.
Which is just fucked up. And it sounds like he also knows just enough to stay on the right side of the law. At least in terms of people's age.
Again, going back to that word of predatory.
Yeah.
That calculating behavior.
Yeah. So I'm just really, really sorry. And I'm at least you don't have to go to that fucking wedding.
Exactly.
You know, that's the one small, small upside, which is that I cannot imagine. Even if she were later to say, like, hey, all's forgiven, I'm not mad anymore, and tried to invite you, don't go.
Yeah,
this is the right outcome. All right. So the next one is actually kind of like lighthearted, given everything else. I actually kind of feel like, oh, this one's a nice little throwaway. The subject is non-binary top surgery. Dear Prudence, I'm a non-binary trans person who's interested in getting top surgery. The insurance industry doesn't have much room for non-binary people who want to access medical transition. So I'm thinking of saying that I'm FTM in order to get my surgery funded through my insurance. Is this offensive, or would it otherwise be harmful to trans men? Which is like, that's like a very sweet question. Like, and certainly, like, I don't want to set myself up as somebody who can, like, give out dispensations like, no, it is not offensive to any trans man alive. Or like, yes, it is offensive to all. Or like, it is offensive to 62% of trans men.
62%.
You have to talk to, you know, 30 before you can do this. So for starters, I'll just say this does not take anything away from trans men. This does not this does not harm trans men. And frankly, I think the idea that you would have to in some way like apologize to or get buy-in from a trans guy, you know, that idea itself that only binary trans people should be able to access whatever aspects of medical transition are right for them, I don't think that that is something that you need to buy into. I don't think that non-binary means that you don't have a right to medical transition. So that, I think, is just a belief that you don't have to worry about, that you don't have to let influence your decision. You have the same right to medical transition as any binary trans guy. And if trans surgery is going to be useful and meaningful to you, you should have it. I hope you get it. I hope that the insurance industry can eventually catch up to realize that there are lots of reasons why top surgery might be genuinely necessary for somebody's well-being. That does not mean that they are like a binary trans guy. And if you need a little certificate, no, that's dumb. We shouldn't get into that. No. So the question, I don't think, should be, you know, is it wrong to do this? No, absolutely not. The question is simply make sure that you're doing everything you need to take care of yourself. So, like, certainly I cannot encourage you to, like, call up your insurance company and be like, you guys won't, like, I don't think they're going to be calling you a year from now and being like, are you binary yet? Like, So I will also say that medical gatekeeping is real and shitty, and that there is a long history of trans people having to say or do things that are not necessarily true to their experience in order to get the medical care that they need. So, you know, bear that in mind as you make the choices that are right for you. And, you know, if top surgery is something that is necessary and useful to you, either in terms of alleviating dysphoria, if that's a phrase that resonates with you. I'm so sorry for saying the word resonates. God, I sound like a monster. or whether it's necessary for your quality of life, for the ease of like not having to bind. Those are all excellent reasons. And I would say whatever information you need to provide your insurance company with in order to make sure that you can get this procedure done, you should do. And certainly if you trust your doctor to talk about things confidentially, you can certainly consider talking to them. If you don't feel safe asking that question to your doctor, if you believe that they would try to withhold care from you, I would simply say that my advice is do whatever you need to do or say in order to get the care that you need, and that you would not ever be harming another trans person by doing that. You could not possibly harm another trans person by getting the care that you need. And I hope that your surgery goes great, and I hope that you get it, and I hope that your insurance is able to cover it for you. And I don't think that I've said anything that could get me in trouble.
Where's that certificate?
I need my own certificate. I need to like kick this up the trans guy chain or something, and like just get a whole wallet full of them. But yeah, top surgery is great. I love it real bad. It's fantastic. You can't see me, but I'm smiling.
Glowing.
I'm very glowy. And before we end the show, I just want to let you all know that the National Domestic Violence Hotline that we recommended for the caller whose husband was threatening suicide and possibly to harm others, it's 1-800-799-7233. And I really, really hope that you will give them a call and that you will do so at a time and a place when you know your husband will not be able to listen in on your conversation. And I wish you all the best. Oh, my goodness. This was a journey. We went.
Yes, it was.
So many different places. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling powerful is not the right word, but the agency. Just thinking about all of the ways in which we all have agency that so often when we're afraid, we forget. Is just really like, I can breathe differently right now.
It's sometimes slightly energizing. I sometimes leave the show feeling like I need to go lie down in a dark room for a full hour.
I can imagine.
Billy Eichner from Parks and Recreation voice. A full hour! and sometimes I leave feeling like, oh man, I could go like do something. And I'm a little more in the like, I could go do something camp right now. So I might go do something.
Yeah, let's go do something.
All right, let's think about it. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I would love to have you back sometime soon. I hope you have a fabulous rest of the day.
Thank you. I've had an amazing time being here.
Yes. Thanks for listening to Dear Prudence. Our producer is Phil Circus. Our theme music was composed by Robin Hilton. Don't miss an episode of the show. Head to slate.com/dearprudence to subscribe. And remember, you can always hear more Prudence by joining Slate Plus. Go to slate.com/prudypod to sign up. If you want me to answer your question, call me and leave a message at 401-371-DEAR, that's 3327, and you might hear your answer on an episode of the show. You don't have to use your real name or location, and at your request, we can even alter the sound of your voice. Keep it short, 30 seconds, a minute tops. Thanks for listening.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.